24th will mark 4 years since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Russia and much of the world was expecting victory within days. Instead, what we have witnessed is 4 years of savage combat that has killed scores of thousands, destroyed entire cities, and displaced millions. The early Ukrainian success, driving Russian forces from the outskirts of Kiev, now seems like a very distant memory. What remains is a grinding attritional battle, with outcomes depending less on the events of the front line and more on the decisions made in Washington and European capitals. Here to talk about the four-year anniversary of the Ukraine war is Geopolity founder Adnan Khan. How are we keeping, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. How are you? It's been a while.
It has been a while. Adnan, I think the best place to begin is, what is the battlefield reality right now?
Okay, so we are coming up to 4 years, and actually by June, the Ukraine war would have lasted longer than World War One. And what's happened is the war has really turned into a war of attrition. It's turned into a grinding war that is wearing down both sides and everyone that's involved. So whilst wars are usually about dramatic breakthroughs or rapid maneuvers, this is now a war. It's really about attrition. Who's going to exhaust the other and who's really going to last longer? So if we look at it from a territorial perspective, you have a 800-mile line that starts from the northeast of Ukraine and it goes all the way to the south to Crimea. The holdings between both countries have largely remained the same, really. From really 2022 to now, what you find is the capture or the loss of territory has been really, really small amounts. This is the type of war it's turned into now. So you've got the Russians who are fighting along a very long line, 800-mile long line. And what they're really trying to do is really bog down the Ukrainian forces, force them to fight along this long stretch in order to overstretch them. The Ukrainians are in a battle for their survival. They are trying to ensure that none of these areas along the axis, that none of these areas are lost by them and Russia can really break through. If we look from a mobilization perspective, you're seeing a lot of numbers coming out from Ukraine, not a lot from Russia, and many from other think tanks. And it seems, though, we're looking at huge personnel losses on both sides. We've got to keep in mind, Russia has a population of 145 million. So that's what they are falling back on to resource the war. Ukraine has a population of about 41 million. That's what they are trying to use to resource this war. So from a mobilization perspective, Russia will always have the edge. But we're looking at losses in the hundreds of thousands, and some are even saying a million. Now, that is not sustainable for the long run. And that's why this is turning into a very exhausting battle of attrition. What this war has shown us is all this talk we used to hear about fancy weapons, precision weapons can defeat an army. What we're seeing is the boring weapons, artillery, tanks and missiles. This is what this war is about. All this talk of, as long as you're cutting edge technology, you can break the back of the enemy. This war has shown again, actually, it's all the boring things that are necessary to win a war. So this is really now a war, a long war, actually, of attrition, of who can endure, who can resource this long-term war. Russia is trying to exhaust the Ukrainians so they crumble. So what happened at the beginning of the war, where Russia performed really badly by trying to do this fancy maneuver, that's completely gone. Russia's now bogged down now, or it's got down to the fact that it's going to have to fight a long war, and they believe they can last longer and survive longer than Ukraine. Ukraine is in a very simple battle, although an existential battle of survival, and can they really be resilient in order to do this? So the battlefield reality hasn't changed much for the last 2 years. But despite that, to maintain that long front, both sides are having to put in resources, having to put in more personnel, having to make sure they can produce. And that obviously is having an impact on both of them. So by June, this war would have gone on longer than World War One. And it really is a question of how long can both sides really continue.
I mean, 4 years is a very long time. What I'm thinking is, how are they able to finance the war for this long. How is Russia and Ukraine's economy doing?
So you're seeing strains on both sides. The main difference here is if you look at Russia, they've completely shifted their economy to a wartime economy, to a war economy. So what that means is they are completely prioritizing everything to do with the production of the war. So, missiles, components, everything needed for the war effort. So what that does is it allows economic growth for a short period of time. But what you're doing is you're disjointing your economy. So anything to do with consumer items, anything to do with what the people need, the priority will always be the war effort. So naturally, you can't continue this forever. You will completely just destroy your economy. People will come out on the streets because they're not getting what they need. So the Russians have shifted to a war economy. And because Russia is a centralized country, they're able to force this through. Ukraine, on the flip side, is completely dependent upon Western support. In fact, they are only fighting today because of Western support. And that support isn't even really great, if you actually look at it. So what you're seeing is when it comes to finance, when it comes to missiles, when it comes to resupply of ordnance that they've used, they are completely reliant upon the West. If the West stops supporting them or they reduce it, they're going to struggle to fight on the front lines. And we're seeing this already. You're seeing, I'm sure we're going to talk about, the Americans want out, although they're still financing them, which is reduced drastically, and they're arming them. The Europeans are making very, very grand promises that they will keep supporting them. What they can deliver on is debatable. So definitely both are being impacted economically. Russia, we can see the strains, but, Russia is a trillion-dollar economy. Russia is an industrial power. Russia already had a defense industry. Ukraine is in a completely different league, really, when it comes to that. So that's why the external support is what's allowing her to remain in this war effort. If that changes, which it looks as, this is going to have a big impact on the front lines.
For a long time, Russia was Europe's source of energy. And in return, Europe became Russia's primary source of income. What does the energy landscape now look like for Europe? Because it's impacted Europe quite a lot.
Yeah, so the energy landscape has completely changed now. Energy has become a weapon of this war. We saw an issue with the Europeans saying, we're out. We're no longer going to buy energy from Russia. We're going to completely diversify. You see Europe looking for alternative markets. Now, this has had an impact on Russia. Russia was selling around 250 billion cubic meters of gas to Europe. This is now nearly half to below 150 billion cubic meters. So what Russia's had to do is find alternative customers. And what did it do? It found China, it found India, and it found Turkey. Russia was exporting around 5 to 6 million barrels of oil a day. That's now gone down to below 5, nearly 4.5. So they're having to find alternative markets for this. The main thing is over 50% of energy exports by Russia was to Europe. That's no longer there. For Europe, around 40-45% of their energy imports came from Russia, which they are now saying that we're not going to do. So what we're finding with Europe now is literally the imports from Russia have dwindled down to into single digits. You've got a few countries in Eastern Europe who are still importing significant amounts of energy from Russia. But overall, Germany have cut their links. And this has had a big impact. It's had a big impact on the European economy. They're having to find alternative sources. Russia was a reliable source of energy, but also the volumes it provided were huge. The challenge Europeans have got now is they're not going to find one other supplier who can supply that amount of energy. So where you had Russia before, now they're finding they're going to have to work with five other suppliers, which really complicates things. So you're looking at Nigeria, you're looking at the Caucasus, Azerbaijan, you're looking at Central Asia. Again, that's a long area. Energy will be coming from further afield now. You've got to build infrastructure for it. So all of this is having an impact, but definitely the European energy landscape has completely changed now. In fact, now China is the number one consumer of Russian energy. And the Europeans are now finding that they either import LNG from America, which costs a lot more, and they're working towards getting more reliable supplies from multiple sources, which again is a big balancing act for them.
Looking at the political situation, there seems to be a plethora of talks going on at the moment. Can you outline some of these talks? What are they hoping to achieve? Do you see them achieving anything?
So there seems to be around three different sets of talks taking place. So you've got the talks between Ukraine and America. You've got the talks now, the trilateral talks between America, Ukraine and Russia. And then you've got the talks that started between America and Russia, which was led by Trump when Putin went to Alaska. So if you look at all three of these, the talks going on between America and Russia directly, now they're quite interesting because firstly, if you remember, Trump said he's going to end this war in 24 hours. That obviously clearly hasn't happened. But what's been happening with these direct talks between America and Russia is there's a lot of talk going on which isn't to do with Ukraine. Ukraine seems to have become one little aspect of the discussion amongst these two countries. What's happened with Ukraine is America seems to have accepted the demands Russia has. In fact, it's actually been promoting the Russian demands, which are the land we've taken, we keep, and there should be no foreign military present in Ukraine, and EU and NATO membership should be off the table. Trump has accepted this, and it's actually been trying to enforce this on Ukraine. So these talks are still ongoing. And what seems to be going on is Russia is making maximalist demands and America seems to be accepting them. And there seems to be a lot of other talk going on at these talks. So they're talking about Arctic energy. They're talking about technology. They're talking about developing the energy fields in Siberia. So the America-Russia talks seem to be a bit more than Ukraine. They seem to be about the American-Russian relationship. Then you've got the talks which are between America and Ukraine. And what happened to Zelensky when Trump came to power, when he was humiliated in the White House, it's really got worse since then. Effectively, what these talks are is the Ukrainians, you need to give up the land that's been taken. This is how the war will end. In fact, Zelensky keeps getting told, you need to end this war, and that means you giving up territory. And what Zelensky is trying to do is, that's a really bad idea. Why should we do that? But if we're going to do that, I want some guarantees. And the guarantees range from NATO membership, NATO base in Ukraine, to security guarantees and working with the European and the Americans. And there's a bit of indifference here, really, between them. Okay, so the other set of talks that are taking, but they've just started recently, the last few months, the trilateral talks. So you've got Russia and Ukraine talking to each other with America overseeing them. Now, these talks are more about hostages, about returning hostages, about food exports coming out of Ukraine and the route they should take and how we can keep them safe. So this is really a detailed level of talks taking place. This is not talking about the strategic picture. So the main thing about the political front is these talks really put Russia in the prime position. They don't take into account Ukraine's position. Ukraine has lost land and they want most of it back, or they're prepared to discuss some of that territory going to Russia. In return, they want security guarantees, and America's not budging on this. What America's saying is they expect Ukraine to give up everything in order to get a deal. What this really shows you is America and Ukraine are not on the same page. America wants to end the war, not with a Ukrainian victory, but with Ukraine just giving up what it needs to in order to bring the war to an end. And obviously, Ukrainians don't want to end the war where they've lost 20% of their territory. They want to end the war where they at least keep most of that territory. So the political talks really have Russia in the advantageous position rather than Ukraine.
So this thing about America-Russia relationship, has that got anything to do with China? I mean, I always hear this term about a reverse Nixon.
You know, it's everything to do with China. In fact, it's becoming more clear now that America never really had any intention of putting in the resources to defeat Russia. What this really was is getting Russia involved in the war and then starting talks that, look, if we end the war, here's what we expect from you. So what seems to be going on is the reason why Trump seems to be accepting the maximalist demands Russia has is America wants to give this on a plate to Russia. And in return, what they want to do is dilute the relationship between Russia and China. So you're talking about transfer of technology. You're talking about developing the hard-to-reach energy fields in Siberia. The Arctic is open up. This has now become a topic of discussion. And what they want is America and Russia work together on these. America's even prepared to give them Ukraine if that's necessary. And the whole idea there really is to dilute the relationship between China and Russia. Now, I think that's quite a big ask from an American perspective. The relationship between Russia and China is quite deep. It's very broad. I think what Russia will try and do is let's maintain our relationship with China and get what we get. And if we can maintain a relationship with America and get the necessary thing, then why not? They're going to want to try and play both sides. So that's why you see Trump's representatives go to these meetings, but then Trump also puts sanctions on Russia. So the two largest oil companies were sanctioned after the Alaska summit, where Trump and Putin met directly. So, you know, Russia's not rolling over. That's not what's going on here. This isn't like the Iran talks where America's demanding, and if you don't give, we're going to bomb you. This isn't what's going on here. Obviously, you know, if you're Ukrainian, you just look at this and think, you know, what side is America on? I thought you were on our side. I thought you were going to be with us until the end. Clearly, the Americans are not. Clearly, the Americans are actually pursuing alternative objectives here, really. And those objectives are not the same objective the Ukrainians have.
So obviously, Russia is in a little bit of a dilemma because, as you previously mentioned, China has become their economic partner in terms of energy. So I guess they can't really abandon China or abandon that relationship. Is that the reason why Russia isn't actually completely in the American court?
There's that, and there's also, look, there's a long history of animosity between both countries. Russia and America were competitors. I mean, as much as Putin may see this as a very useful deal, you know, he's probably thinking, how much can you trust America? So why would you abandon your relationship with China completely for America? You can't trust America. Look what America's done to the Kurds recently. Look what they're doing to the Ukrainians. So what Putin will likely do, or what the Russian leadership will do, is look, let's work with America and get as much of a deal as we can. They won't abandon the Chinese deal. This is going to take a lot more work from America. But you're seeing already, Trump came to power. He humiliated Zelensky. Zelensky's being told the way this war ends is you need to agree to the terms. And the Ukrainian terms aren't even part of the discussion. The terms are you, Ukraine, need to accept Russia's terms. And Russia's terms are the 20% of Ukraine we've taken, you've got to give up. And they don't want any foreign military presence in the country, which obviously means a big lot. I mean, if Ukraine was going to agree to that, they didn't need to fight the war for 4 years. They could just agree to that at the beginning when Russia invaded. But they didn't agree to that because the West was saying, we are with you to the end, whatever it takes. And now they're being abandoned. So, you know, the Russians have a long history that they know that despite periods of peace and stability and cooperation, the underlying relationship between the West and Russia is one of animosity and competition.
So ultimately, this makes sense now why America has done a complete U-turn on the issue.
Yeah, I mean, I've come to the conclusion this was probably the agenda all along. What they needed was for Russia to invade, for Russia not to win outright in a dramatic way. They needed the Ukrainians to get into the war and bog down Russia to some degree. They needed Europeans to abandon the energy relationship. That's all been achieved now. So what now America is doing is ultimate goal, if you think about it, its ultimate global objective is to confront China. And part of that is, can they dilute the relationship Russia has with China? If they can, then they will confront China on their own. And once they've dealt with China, they will then come back for a very powerful Russia. So, you know, this is, you know, there's no permanent friends or permanent enemies in politics, in the system, as politics is now. Really, you know, every enemy is a future ally, and every ally today could be a future enemy or someone we can abandon. I mentioned this before. Look at the Kurds now in Syria. After 13 years of being told that America's behind America, just abandon them altogether. You know, America's got other objectives, and unfortunately, you know, we're talking about people's lives here. Unfortunately, you've got this scenario. This war is really a war between Russia and the West. And the West is led by America. The battlefield, unfortunately, is the Ukrainian people. And really, the Ukrainian leadership should have gone to Moscow at the beginning and got some deal. Because the deal they're getting now is the worst deal. The deal now is you've got to give up 20% of your country. in the early 6 months to a year when Russia had messed up its original invasion, Ukraine was in a strong position. The problem now with talks is when the Ukrainians sit in front of the Russians, why should the Russians give any inch? They're winning. They're creating conditions which are difficult for Ukraine to maintain. So why should I give up anything? I want 20% of your territory, everything I've taken. Why should I even give an inch of that? I'm in the winning position. And how can Ukraine impose itself on Russia? It can't. It's not winning on the battlefield. It's struggling on the battlefield. So this is the unfortunate situation they're in. And, you know, America has broader goals it's pursuing. Ukraine, unfortunately, the means to an end.
So I'm thinking about two different things now. One is China, and the second one is Europe. Obviously, Europe has now seen America abandoning its ally, abandoning Ukraine. It's in a weaker position in terms of energy. Where does Europe currently stand in a general sense?
So Europe has been put on notice by America. What you're seeing is, from an American perspective, you Europeans, we've had enough of bailing you out. We've had enough of leading you. We've had enough of really you being aligned with us, but 90% of the resources from America, not from you. So what Ukraine's being told, if you want to continue the war, you go for it. But you're not getting anything from America. And unless the Europeans are prepared to resource you, then really you need to come to a negotiating table and come to negotiation with Russia. So the Europeans are promising everything. They're saying, you know, we're getting our troops together, we're pouring more money into our industries, we're pouring more money into defense, we've started national service programs. They are promising well beyond what they're capable of actually providing. Obviously, the problem for Europeans is if Russia takes over 20% of Ukraine, Russia's expanding and it's expanding into Europe. So the view here is look, it's unlikely Russia is going to expand further into Europe. But the history of Europe and Russia is both of them have always tried to expand both ways. The Europeans have constantly tried to expand into Russia, and Russia has tried to defend themselves by creating a buffer zone the other way. So this is what's going on. So really, the Ukraine war is just part of a centuries-old battle that's actually taking place. So for the Europeans, this is the big problem. America's out. And if Europe gets, if Russia gets stronger by taking over Ukraine, that is a big problem for the Europeans. But the Europeans are promising, you know, they're promising well beyond what they're capable of actually delivering. And this is something that Ukrainians got to be careful about.
So now on the other side, China. Is China aware of American plans? Is it something that they've kind of realized and worked out?
Yeah, so China can see what's going on. So China obviously has helped Russia from the perspective they've replaced Europe in terms of energy imports. And there's actually been not significant military help, but there's been help in terms of advice. And just Russia and China seeming as though they're one block. So you've got Russia, China, you've got North Korea, and you've got Iran. They're trying to present themselves as a block. But the fundamental resourcing of this war is fundamentally from Russia. So obviously what Russia's saying is, look, we're not on our own. We've got allies. And that's where China comes in. China's happy with that. So China's not having to put significant resources into this. It's given Russia political cover. It's saying we're on the Russian side, but it's not having to put troops on the ground or anything like that. But definitely China is on the Russian side.
So Trump is now saying, his latest statement is that he wants the war to be over by June. I mean, he's made these promises multiple times. Do you think that's possible?
Well, this sounds like, you know, when I come to power, I'm going to end the war in 24 hours. That came to pass. I think when he made this statement, he was trying to impose and put pressure on Zelensky that he's been talking to Putin for a year now. He's been saying the war needs to end. And now he's putting a deadline for Zelensky. And what Zelensky is doing is he's trying to get concessions. He's trying to get more commitment by America and Europe of putting either troops in Ukraine, having a base in Ukraine. I mean, he even said, why don't you put your nuclear weapons in Ukraine? He just wants anything that if Russia ever invades or tries to take more, the Europeans are going to have to get involved. The West are going to have to get involved. And what the West seem to be doing, they're promising everything, but are they really going to deliver? Because do you want to go with Russia? Do you want to go to war with Russia over Ukraine? they may say they do, but really they don't. They don't have the resources. They don't have the capabilities. So I think when Trump made this statement, it was to put pressure on Zelensky that, look, you're beating around the bush. You know, you keep coming to meetings, you keep adding additional conditions. You've got until June. So effectively, after June, we're out. But, you know, Trump probably does more U-turns than any other president that we've seen.
What do you think the ideal outcome is for all the countries that are involved?
Okay, so for Russia, this was an existential issue. The Europeans and the West are expanding all the way to their border. So their ideal outcome is they take the 20% territory, and they've sent a message to Europe that enough's enough, that we've got to defend Russia. So that would be their ideal outcome. Anything less than that, and remember, Russia has took Crimea many, many years ago. It's occupied 20% of the country for a long time now. So anything less than that is a bit of a loss. From a Ukrainian perspective, their ideal outcome would be is they get the territory back. I think they know deep down somewhere between 0 to 20% of their territory is going to go. So the less you could do, the better. Their ideal situation would be they don't lose any of it. But even they know that. But what you find with the talks is they're not even wanting to discuss this. The Ukrainians are just like avoiding discussing territorial concessions. What they're saying is we'll do territorial concessions, but we want guarantees from you. We want guarantees from the EU, from NATO, from America. And they keep beating around the bush, really, around these meetings. So the ideal for them is that or the least amount of territory that they lost. For America, the ideal outcome is they get a talking or a working relationship with Russia over this. That's why they're prepared to sell out Ukraine, and they have a really good relationship with Russia that they can then use to dilute their relationship with China. For the Europeans, their ideal would be the war comes to an end and they do something that halts Russia's advance into Europe. Exactly what that is, I don't even think they know, to be honest with you, at the moment. Because any expansion of Russia is bad for them. Russia's getting more powerful. And then, yeah, they are right to some degree. Who's to say Russia won't expand even more? You could have a lull period, and then Russia does it again. So you can see the ideal outcome for all of these countries is very, very different. Even the West, who are supposed to be the same side, the ideal outcomes are very divergent from each other. So what you might find, if Europe gets what they want, that could not be what the Ukrainians want. If America gets what they want, that is not what the Europeans or the Ukrainians want as well. So that's what makes the whole thing really, really messy.
Around 4 years on, I want to revisit some aspects of the war and ask you what we know now that we didn't know 4 years ago. First thing, why did Russia invade Ukraine? Have we got more insight into this?
Yes, so the negotiations taking place, the different talks, it's made it clear now that for Russia, there's no territorial concessions. So what that means is they invaded because they felt the West now are coming up to their border. So they saw this invasion as an existential issue, that the West have crossed the red line and we have to respond. So this isn't some colonial imperial objective. This is Russia's under threat and we have to respond. Now, I actually thought, and we've done a couple of podcasts on this, there could have been other ways Russia could have reacted than the military option. Here we are 4 years down the line. That is not the ideal outcome for Russia. They wanted a quick, swift victory. That obviously didn't happen. So for Russia, they see this from the lens of we are under threat as a nation, existential, so we have to respond. That's why it was a very risky endeavor. And this you can see, that's why they're not prepared to compromise on even 1% of the territory they've got. The starting point is the territory we've taken, you have to officially hand it over to us. If you don't officially hand it over to us, we'll keep fighting. We're winning the war. We can resource it more. And they've got no problem going back to war. The Ukrainians can't afford that. The Ukrainians are being told by their supporters, you've got to end it. And actually, they don't have the resources for it. The resources are all coming from the West. So that's the reason. So that's the reason why the war happened from the Russian perspective.
Why did Russia start the war so poorly?
So we know now the reason why they started it poorly is because they thought that if we very quickly mobilized and drove into Kiev and captured the president and the regime fell, the whole war will be over, right? And that on its own isn't a problem if they fought like that. If that was your plan and that was your strategy, then you need to put in the resources to achieve it. What Russia did is their resources weren't based on the worst case scenario. Their resources were based upon their best case scenario, which is our overwhelming force will go in and the regime will just cripple. So what they did was the ultimate own goal that anyone does in a war. Even if you are in an easy war, you still put in the resources to have overwhelming force. So for example, they didn't even mobilize the whole army when they went into Ukraine. They just used the standing army they had because they thought they're going to win. In fact, everybody thought they were going to win pretty easily. In fact, the Americans were telling the Ukrainians, and we know now from the intelligence from America, they were telling the Ukrainians to get ready for the guerrilla war that they're going to do afterwards once they're occupied. So no matter how powerful you are, you still have to put troops on the ground to win the war, no matter how easy you believe it is. So what Russia did, they got caught out by going on the best case scenario rather than resourcing on the worst case scenario. Now they're paying for it 4 years down the line.
Why have we not seen nuclear weapons being used? I mean, it was something that was talked about many times.
The reason why nuclear weapons haven't been used is because all the talk of using nuclear weapons was exactly that. It was just talk. No one ever planned to use nuclear weapons. The European, the West would talk about nuclear weapons to get their populations on board, that the actions we're doing to support Ukraine, we should continue doing. We should support Ukraine and you need to get behind it, but there might be a nuclear war. That's why the Europeans did it. So they did it to effectively scare their populations that the actions of the governments to support Ukraine is the right action. The Russians used to shout nuclear weapons when they felt that the number of weapons or the support going to Ukraine will help Ukraine in the war effort. So what they effectively were doing was trying to threaten them that if you cross this red line, we might consider nuclear weapons. Here we are 4 years down the line. Keep in mind, Russia has lost wars before and not used nuclear weapons. They left humiliated from Afghanistan, didn't use nuclear weapons. They were defeated in Chechnya originally, they didn't use nuclear weapons. And again, Ukraine and Russia share a border. Nuclear weapons don't respect borders. So if you use a nuclear weapon, you're going to create a massive radioactive hole in the ground where no one's going to be able to live for 1,000 years. What Russia wants is to acquire, seize the territory, use it as a buffer zone. So a nuclear weapon doesn't really help in that. So all this talk was always nonsense. It was always propaganda from the European side and the Russia side. And that's why nuclear weapons have... So despite losing potentially 1 million troops in this war, the use of nuclear weapons still isn't an option.
Whatever happened to World War III?
So you could argue it's technically taking place. Again, it was part of the propaganda war. You got the old Russia on one side, you got the West on one side. It's a civilizational battle. We all need to get on board. All the public needs to get on board. Remember, we have a very war-weary public. The Iraq-Afghan wars told a lot of people, showed a lot of people actually, that forget these wars. In America, all the talk is America first. Forget these forever wars. So the talk of World War III is, if we don't get involved now, things will get really bad and they will blow out of proportion. So again, this is all part of the propaganda war.
Final question for you, Adnan. On this fourth anniversary, what is the key lesson that needs to be learnt?
So I think really the key lesson that everyone needs to learn is this war has proven certain things that we've got to keep in mind. And anyone who believes they can rely on Russia on one side and the West on one side, they should keep these points in mind. Firstly, is that the West have their own strategic objectives. Their objectives are not the same as Ukraine's objectives. The Ukrainians want to survive. They want to keep their country. They want to keep it sovereign. That is not the objective of the West. Their objectives are completely different. Taking help from the West can be deadly. The Ukrainians were told, we will help you no matter how long it takes and no matter what it takes. And what we've seen in the last 4 years is every time the Ukrainians asked for weapons, it turned into a debate, whether it was jets, artillery, tanks, and long-range weapons. In the end, when the West gave these weapons, they didn't give enough and they came too late to make any difference. So if you take help from the West, it will be deadly. And that's something you should keep in mind. As I mentioned, Zelensky was told the West has got your back. In the first 2 months of the war, Zelensky was about to sit down directly with the Russians. And Boris Johnson and Joe Biden ran to Ukraine and said, no, 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 we've got your back. And now the same leader is being told, you need to agree to territorial concessions in order to end the war. So, you know, you can't really trust the West. So the Europeans have been telling Zelensky that we've got your back. And they keep dangling EU membership and NATO membership in front of him. Ukraine's not being given any signs of when permanent membership will happen. In fact, they're actually now being told that it's probably not a good idea. And we're making a promise of membership of the institution in the future, but don't expect anything tangible as well. So what Ukraine unfortunately misunderstood is the context of the global context we're in. There's a battle taking place between China and Russia on one side and the West, led by America, on the other side. And the battlefield is the whole world. And Ukraine is the battlefield at the moment. So therefore, what Ukraine wants is not what the West wants. This is the fundamental problem. And just finally on this, even if Russia wins, what is Russia offering the world? What is Russia saying about how the world should look? This is purely like a nationalistic objective. The Russians are not the Soviet Union. There's no ideological message or any message for the world. So even if Russia wins, they have forever lost the hearts and minds of the Ukrainians. So even if they win, which they likely will, what will happen is the 20% of territory will become a hell for them in the future. You will probably have a low-level insurgency gang on for decades after this. So what was the point of the victory? And so for Russia, this literally is the territorial concessions. It will be a territorial win. They have actually nothing else to offer the world.
Thank you for your time today, Adnan. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolicy.com. And you can also learn more on many other issues by accessing our website. You'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.